It is March the 19th, 2013. We're at Club Palenza. I'm sat here with Nick Craig, and we've at last managed to sit down, and we've been nattering away, and then we realised we'd better actually put some of it down on, not down on wax, but we've got to put it down, haven't we?
Put it down.
Yeah. In the background, you can hear tennis rackets. It's about, what do you reckon now?
Warm enough,
yeah.
T-shirt.
Jeans rolled up. And it's nice and warm.
Sun cream's on.
So, for people, because this podcast is for quite a spectrum of different athletes, triathletes, duathletes, runners, sportive riders, people that are just into their fitness. 1 minute on you, your background, and what you do.
I am Nick Craig. I've ridden bikes since I was 9. I rode professionally for 16 years, from 91 to 2005, and then drifted into a more endurance background, doing enduro mountain bike events. So I've done cyclocross, mountain bike, and some road racing to support the mountain biking, and I've even done a bit of track racing.
Okay, what's your typical week from the point of view of obviously work and pleasure combined? When, for a lot of people, when they're in this industry, you know, there's things that you do that are your training, but also the your work. What would be a, and it's a very eclectic mixture, but what would be a typical week for you?
I work as a technical rep for Scott Sports UK, so I support sales reps up and down the country. So I actually spend a lot of time driving a van. So whenever I'm driving a van, I always dream of riding my bike. So there's always a selection of bikes in the back of my van when I'm travelling. So it could be, I could be passing through South Wales and grab an hour on a trail in Cwmcarn, or it could be an evening ride with a group from shop. It's really, really mixed up, from probably up to 150mm travel, all mountain bikes, to winter fully mudguarded bikes, cross bikes, to XC race bikes. So you know, it could be any one of those bikes in the back of the van, and I just literally enjoy riding my bike. I'm 44 next week, so I just to give you an idea of how old I am, I've been doing this quite a long time, and I don't follow any structured training anymore. I just ride my bike off my kind of background and experience. And I think if somebody like yourself was to assess what I did, you'd probably see that I tick quite a few of the boxes when it comes to zoning out your training. And I kind of just do that by default now, because I've been doing that long.
Well, when you're next down our way then, load up a TT bike in the back of that van and ride aero bars for the first time in your life.
Never. I say I'd never ridden aero bars? I think I had some clip-on aero bars in. I rode an event in Monterey in California, the Sea Otter Classic.
Oh yeah.
I'm trying to remember the year. It'll come back to me in a minute. It'd be in the 2000s, and they have a road stage race called the Sea Otter, but they also have a mountain bike stage race runs parallel to it called the Sea Otter. What they do is they have a thing called the Iron Otter, and that's the person, the rider, the athlete that rides both events.
Ah.
And it's quite a complex one, because you'll do the dirt crit from the mountain bike event, which could be a 22 minutes blasting round a short circuit, whilst they're holding the start of the road race for the Sea Otter road race, and they'll wait for the mountain bikers that are daft enough to try and do both to then clip onto the road bike and go and do it. I did that, and that involved me riding up a bike path for 5 miles, and we were just working out the back of a small little van. I was riding for Team GB at the time. We were there preparing for a race, a World Cup in Napa Valley the week after. So we pulled our little car up, hire a car onto the parking lot for the event, for the actual prologue, for the roadside of the prologue. And it was a 5 miles down a bike path. The Mercury team needed to park their big truck, so we just politely said, oh, you can have our space, and we moved our little car. And the mechanic said, oh, what bike are you riding? So I showed him a bike, and he went, do you want some clip-ons? So I got some ski sticks mounted on the front there, and then half an hour later he came back over and said, do you want a disc wheel? So I actually rode with a rear solid disc and some clipped bars. My glutes and lower back certainly knew about it, having never, ever stooped so low. And I'm all right, Joe, actually. That's the, of all the bikes that I mentioned about travel and road and cross bikes, I think I can safely say that I'm quite comfy sitting in an unaerodynamic position.
So what's your... Because, you know, we've spoken a lot already, and we've spoken a lot before about how there are things, like you've just said, that, you know, particular bits of... componentry or even types of riding and stuff that you don't necessarily automatically do, but there's a heck of a lot of crossover. And we spoke about one particular thing, which was this whole idea of, did you call them phosphate sixes or something like that?
You described a session we're doing this afternoon.
Yeah.
And I said, is that phosphate sprints?
That's right, phosphate sprints, yeah.
Used to do a lot of, and I used to slot them in between a series of World Cups, and they used to make me feel good.
Yeah, and this is this idea. So for people that are listening, this is this idea that the energy system that is the, what's called the phosphocreatine system, is a burst of anything from as short as sort of 4 to 6 seconds up to maybe 10 seconds. And this idea is that you put a high amount of power out, not necessarily, you know, try and bend the bike into all manner of contortions. You just surge, you're probably likely to get at least 150% of your ramp power maximum if you were to be watching it on a power meter, and you still ignite all of those fibers up and running, but you stop before they start making and consuming lactate. So you get this surge, but it feels good afterwards, yeah?
Mm.
Yeah, kind of opens your legs up.
Yeah.
Yes, and what was when you were doing them? Which that was under, was that under Simon Jones at the time? Was that
that was Dave Smith.
With Dave Smith, that's right. So, what was the sort of rationale philosophy that you were told to? Why did you think you were doing them, or what was? Because you were told.
You're testing my memory now. No, we were told that the rationale was exactly what you said, that you accrue an amount of muscle mass to accelerate, and it should feel like you are on top of the gear at about 8 seconds, and the effort would finish about 10 seconds, and it was never any longer. It wasn't doing any damage. It didn't make you feel tired. It just made you feel good.
Yeah.
And we used to do it with a gap, and then do one more, and then a gap.
Yeah. And you spoke of 3 minutes.
I remember 3 minutes.
Yeah, and I said, you know, 2 minutes is minimum to allow that system to recharge. And of course, there'll always be somebody that does one and 40 seconds later says, oh, I think I feel great again. And it's no, your energy system is the same as Nick's, is the same as a pro rider, is the same as somebody that's a fitness rider. Your energy system still takes a minimum of 2 minutes to recharge. And it may, you know, you may do 3 minutes to recharge, but you've got to let that system properly, like a battery, you know, it has to have full recharge or you're not going to get the right performance out of it again. So it is this idea that you kind of do it, and I always think of them as like fake efforts, because you do them and you think, not quite sure about that. Then you finish a ride, you maybe done 2 blocks of 8 or 10 of them, so you might do, you know, say 16 to 20 of them in a ride, but afterwards your legs feel good.
Day before a World Cup, mountain bike, what do I want?
Yeah. You want your legs to feel good.
So
feel good, yeah.
I would always drop 6 or 8 of them into a 1 hour session the day before a World Cup, and I, you know, for me that it structured that hour instead of just going out and parking my backside on the chair and getting a sore bum. Gave me something to do.
Yeah.
And I used to quite enjoy that session. I'd forgotten about it in this new life of mine, and we're gonna go out and do some this afternoon, so I'm quite looking forward to refinding the
because it's a different, you know, it brings It brings, not sprinting, but it brings accelerations at a high effort into normally training for most endurance athletes, which just, you know, composes of going out and tapping the pedals or running along. And actually this idea of making this energy system ignite is perfectly relevant to endurance athletes. It, you know, people that say they've only got one speed are missing it. You've got various energy system speeds, but you've got to hit them at the right amount of effort and have the right amount of recovery to do them. And I think as part of a base ride, and I get people to do them the day before a race because it keeps them snappy, it makes them feel good, but they don't go off and start doing, you know, 5 minute reps at threshold, which you want in your legs tomorrow. You don't want to do it the day before. It's going to be in there. Don't worry about whether it's there or not. It is there. And instead do the phosphate surges, which make you feel good, stop you from going bamboozling off and doing some, you know, almost like some, not an ego session, but something that makes your confidence boost. Actually, those make your confidence boost because you feel afterwards, wow, legs feel nice and open. And
well, yeah, what I realised, Joe, was that it's no good only ever doing them the day before the race, though, because no, then
they're too novel.
Yeah,
yeah.
So it was something that I probably had in a, you know, I may do it once a week.
Yeah, yeah.
And then would target, you know, it's real benefit would be the day before the World Cup.
Yeah.
But my body was kind of used to it. I'm no sprinter. I consider myself an endurance athlete.
Yeah.
And in a race situation, I will try and avoid having to sprint with anybody.
Yeah.
However, when I used to perform at that level, I was jumping out of corners constantly in mountain bike and cyclocross, and that was something that I had to be good at.
Yeah.
And that you know, often the difference between the guys I was racing with was how you accelerated out of the corner.
Mm.
And that could be using technical power delivery, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, you've still got a portion of that as a system that allows you to accelerate.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I get comfy with accelerations through doing those workloads.
That was young Roy we just saw going out there, putting more miles in the bank. Yeah. Yeah, and I think the other thing about them is that even if they don't automatically click, like you say, they aren't just to do the day before race. There's something to do, and I quite like the idea of people doing them on rollers if they're forced indoors, because it breaks it up again, and it means that, you know, it's not about you doing, you know, a Cavendish for 30 seconds. No, you're doing a surge that still opens up. Anyone measuring power will see this. They will spike power. You're at least, I mean, it's very difficult to only even go to 100% of your ramp test power. That isn't that much work. So you're more likely going to be doing 150% of your ramp test maximum and still thinking, oh, actually, that wasn't a real massive sprint. You can probably double that in a massive sprint quite easily. And people that are real sprinters can probably triple their ramp test. But it's this sense that if you do it and you believe that, as you said, you were doing that, what was that, 15 years ago? You know, the energy systems haven't changed. If people believe in it and do it right, afterwards they're not going to feel exhausted and pummeled. It's not an interval session. It's kind of like a constructive technique session as well, because you are actually surging. You need to learn how to be able to press the pedals and go in a straight line, not try and bend the frame side to side or wiggle all over the road. So you sort of almost practice adding power at the pedals but keeping in a straight line. But you get back and you don't feel tired, and that's the point of the session. You get back and go, oh, okay, so that was it.
Yeah.
Next day your legs are going to feel great.
Part of it for me as well was decelerating through cadence. So at the top of the effort, at 8 seconds, that next 2 seconds, as you the gear becomes easy and you ramp down, is that, you know, a full-time bike rider should be able to maintain a good cadence and smooth pedaling action back into the normal rest period, ready to recharge.
Yeah.
And that felt like part of the effort.
Yeah, not you don't sense. Just stop. Yeah, you don't just push really fast and stop.
No.
You're trying to let the legs go and then feel the gear coming back in again.
Yeah, and it just felt right. And you know, I've done it on the turbo.
Yeah,
I'm not a big user of rollers for personal reasons. It's not that I can't balance. I do need to raise my bum off the saddle a lot more than most people. So I'm more turbo and, you know, a decent turbo that allows really smooth pedaling. I can get out the saddle. But great turbo session to do with phosphate sprints. And within a group. I've done it, you know, out in a group, not an issue at all with a good company.
Yeah. So I'm just going to ask you a random amount of different questions because we've gone through loads of topics and stuff. We did a climb yesterday, called Batala, I think we worked out was the proper name, though lots of people call it Look. What's it like? You've been, you know, at a very high level in the sport, and then you come back and you start up that climb. Like we said, it was about 20 to some of the clients were about 40 minutes. You get into it and it starts feeling like, you know, this is quite good. Do you forget, and I'll say before I ask you the question, I do you forget that you're in your 40s and it's just like being a kid again, going up a hill hard, and you forget that your body is older? Because it doesn't make any difference, it's still you against you.
I'm just out there doing it. I don't think anything, dead right, I don't think anything about how old I am. We talked about riding out there and riding out there in zone one.
Yeah.
And I was with a group of people on the camp that it was quite hard for me to ride at zone one in that group. And
not because of your fitness, but because it feels a bit slow at times.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know that when I get there, there's a little competitor in me.
Yeah.
That the plan is to ride this climb at like TT effort, and that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
So I was probably the last one to leave the car park and started the clock and rode up there in my world. Found the rhythm.
Yeah.
Got on top of it.
Yeah.
Me, asked me to do an effort. If you put a number on my back, there's no doubt you would get a bit more out of me, but I can go to a good level in a specific training session. And the whole day was about that effort, and I went out there and did the effort that everyone else was doing on the camp. At whatever level the riders are on this camp, we all had the opportunity to ride at our own level.
Yeah.
Which the only thing you can say is less time for me, but no less pain.
Exactly. And you know, that was then supplemented by coming back down off the climb and then going out and, you know, putting in another couple of hours of zone one. So we split it up, but that middle 20 to 40 minutes was meant to be really hard effort, and you just click in and that's it, and you just think, here we go,
in the zone.
Yeah. And you could see, you know, quite a few people were going up there, you know, going as fast as they could, and it's the same for everybody, really. You know, it doesn't get any easier. Somebody said in a seminar we said last night, you know, it was, you know, it never gets any easier. If you think it's going to get easier, then no, it might be a little less time, but as it's less time, you can be a few percent harder because you're doing it for less time, so you can actually go up a few percent because you're doing, you know, half the time of somebody that takes 40 minutes. So it never gets easy. If you want it to get easy,
it's very difficult for me to comment on what people that aren't so fit feel like doing that same effort. But I would say I know what it's going to feel like is probably the difference.
Yeah.
I know that effort's going to hurt, and I know how much it's going to hurt, and I hope for good sensations in the body and the legs and the mind. And they were there yesterday, and that's nice to get those sensations. I guess people that have done less of it would arrive at that car park at the bottom, saw a bit of nervous eating going on. Bit late for that.
Yeah.
And I would say that those guys and girls, a few of them maybe don't quite know what the pain is going to be like or what to expect. So it's easier when you know what that should feel like. That's probably the main difference, I would say, between somebody that's been doing it a lot longer and not.
Yeah. And also, when we spoke about this, about, you know, you kind of know that you don't, like you said, you know, you ride into it. You know, you don't go off the first couple of stretches and give it full gas and then hit the third, fourth corner going, blimey, I've gone too hard here. You know how hard you need to go because we've said, it's about 20 minutes. So you automatically know that I'm not going to be on the limit of 4 minutes in, because you're just finding that sweet spot for the day, which can alter. You know, you wouldn't say you're like a robot and say, well, I know it's going to be, you know, 300 and whatever watts, because that's exactly what I do day in, day out for that effort.
I knew straight away that I probably started 50 metres back from the sign, rolled into it and accelerated progressively, knowing that if I go 9,500% in the first half mile, I will crawl the last half of the 20 minutes. I do what, you know, it's really nice to see when you watch somebody doing like a tour time trial, somebody like David Miller ramps into the effort. They roll off the start line, they use the momentum and look like they're going quick.
Yeah.
But you can see that they're actually just rolling off the ramp, using momentum to get up to speed, and they spend, I guess, the first 40 seconds winding up to get up to speed.
Yeah.
And they don't try and win that time trial in that first 40 seconds.
Or even in the first minute. You know, they're just finding their way. And I think that's probably what experience of going hard gives people. We spoke to the clients the day before about sort of doing that. I think it's just this idea of, like, put yourself on the line, but the more you do that, the more you know where that line is. Therefore, if you are presented with something that somebody says, oh, this is going to be really hard for the next 15 minutes, you know what you can do for 15 minutes. Therefore, there isn't a big question mark as to, oh, I hope I can survive. Actually, if you know where that line is, you can just do it to be able to actually give yourself more confidence. You weren't at the bottom thinking, oh, I hope I can make it to the top. You just thought, I know what I'm looking to do if it's 20 minutes. I know what I should be feeling like in those last 4 minutes, because you've done it hundreds of times. And that, and I think that even for the fitness rider or runner or person who does a triathlon and says, I just want to get around, I think when you tempt yourself to get near to your limit in a time trial, it is the race of truth. It'll probably tell some people truisms they don't really want to accept, or always have a asterisk next to it saying, oh, but if only this or if only that. But actually, it's your little measure, and the more you know where that measure is, the more you just ultimately understand how your body ticks. And your body, you must be able to sense, you know, within that minute of, oh yeah, I can feel the legs today, as to what, you know, you haven't been doing so much that you were exhausted going into it. So you could just feel yourself into it. And then for the rest of the time, you knew exactly what you were doing. Whereas I did see people literally on the climb slowing down quite significantly, but they obviously were with people that they couldn't keep up with. And they fake it, and bang. And as a pro, you learn to know where that banging bit is. You just never get there, because you don't want to get there unless you can just about see the finish line. And this is building towards what for you? What?
I've got a season of combination of a few MPS, which is National Point Series mountain bike events. I'm not doing all the series, but I will aim to try to win the British Marathon Mountain Bike Championships on June the 8th in Selkirk. Missed out by about 7 seconds last year. Won it two or three times, I think. It's quite a competitive area. People like Ollie Beckinsale, Dan Fleeman, and Lee Williams is a reigning champion from Wales. So there's a good portion of, you know, high-end athletes that want to win that title, and I'll be a 44-year-old vet actually racing against the elites, and that's where I feel that I should be racing, having done a career that I've done. I kind of don't feel that I should be, you know, whilst I'm still spending 8, 10, 12 hours a week on my bike, I think I can still perform at that level. So I do.
And longer term, it's a different scenario, obviously, when you're not being paid specifically to sort of, you know, deliver results as a pure pro, as a sense. And what keeps you in that, you know, that motivation, that want to do it? And I know you've said before, and it's, oh, I just love riding my bike, but Is that central to all of this? Yeah. That it's just, yeah. Yeah,
it's central to it, because I finished in 2000. I rode the Sydney Olympics on mountain bike, and whilst I was there, I was asked if I would support Max Schiandri in the road race. I had a great time. I was never going to get a medal. I was probably dipping into the top 10 in the world at the time in mountain bike. And I've got to say, I was following quite strict training and diet, nutrition training programs. I was working hard. I actually lost the love for the sport. And in 2002, Manchester Commonwealth Games, I failed to get selected. And a lot of people kind of went, oh, well, that's the end of his kind of career, he's 33. And I just took a big, deep breath, went out for a long bike ride, and just remembered why I love riding bikes. So I decided that, you know, I've got a lot of experience. There's a lot of... Scott were really supportive. They came to me in 2005 and said, we'd really like you to... cover all our endurance events so that Ollie Beckinsale can focus on national points and continue with his Olympic ambition. So this is, I ended up spending more time doing long distance, and at late 30s, mid to late 30s, it felt so easy to be more diesel driven in the summer. Yeah. So I was, you know, strong enough to ride for 100k off-road over 3 to 5 hours, and what I did find was, because I was working as well, that the weekends became a big portion of my training. So the events I was doing, without doing the events, I wouldn't, so I might do a night enduro Saturday night of 50k, 60k, and then it might be a 70 or 80k on the Sunday, and then I'd be in the van driving, riding with customers at other people's pace, and I found that the engine that I built, I spent 20 years building to be, try and be the best I could be, was actually really useful for being pretty good in the UK, maybe not worldwide. And I really, really kind of thrived in the enjoying bike riding. I love it. I absolutely love it. And it's something that I will do until I stop loving it.
Yeah. No, that I think is key, because we... we have seen several surges in participation in the last sort of 15 years, and you know, we're on the crest of another surge, and it's quite easy to sort of forget that these are people coming in that sometimes they've not even sat on a bike, and you just assumed, well, sure, everyone, you know, you think everyone was, as a kid, was, you know, not even at a competitive level, but was sat on a bike riding and did stuff, and they don't, and they come into it, and sometimes they need to have the central love of what they're doing first, and if it's going to go anywhere, well, you better be doing it when you're young, because you can't really normally take it up in your 30s or 40s and it likely, you know, change your career or your bank account. Very few and far between. But if the central love is there, and you train accordingly, and you just keep doing it, then actually you find that you'll get to whatever point, but at least, you know, the journey's been worth it, because you keep that love of it. And I sometimes think people need to not dilute their aspirations, but just have patience as to what's going on.
Yeah, I feel fit. I feel fit. I feel healthy, and I feel fit.
Yeah.
Yeah, still got, you know, a lot more pedaling in me. And whilst I feel fit and it makes me feel good, I grew up with probably ill-educated diet, and I've, through the experiences of being a full-time bike rider, learned what food makes me feel like. And when food makes me feel good, then if I eat the right food, I can then train. If I eat the wrong food, and I've learned that, you know, I have actually, at the end of your career, people say, so what do you do now then? I eat what I want to eat. And actually that's a far different from when I was 16 or 17 and I was eating all the wrong foods. Now if you tried to take the good food off me, I would struggle, because what is the healthy food is the food that I really love. Yeah. And I do, you know, I have a very balanced diet that helps me, and it's it just, I eat on feel. I eat what I eat when I eat. I eat a lot. I burn a lot of calories. I seem to, a few people said, oh, when you hit your 40s, the weight will creep on you, it'll slide on without you really knowing. Whilst I'm active, it could be active, family active, some training, some work. I stand up a lot in work, and you know, we all know sports people like to sit down. You're not sitting down, lie down. That's the ultimate pro athlete and Olympic athlete's way of thinking. I stand at work a lot, and I'm burning calories while I'm stood up, and then I sit in the car. So I don't, you know, when I sit in the car, it doesn't bother me so much. Yeah. So I just do what I've got to do, and I never ever think I shouldn't be, you know, as a pro bike rider. I think back to 15 years ago, I would sit down. I just got lazy, really.
Yeah, but also at the volume of training you were doing, you needed to be, because you couldn't bounce around everywhere and keep on top of the training.
No, and I look back now, and actually the only thing, if I was to never say, I don't like to ever wish I'd done anything different, but if the hardest discipline for me in my professional career was probably not training, because I love it so much. So I actually needed to, probably would have taken some of the volume out and focus more on the right intensities, and had the discipline to, it was a discipline not to do it. You know, people say you've really got to want this to be good. There was no doubt about how much you want it. There's a good portion of people want it too much, and you can work too hard and not smart enough.
Yeah,
and
with
a bit more smart training, and that usually needs somebody to guide you with that. You need help, even at a pro level, even with some good amount of experience. You need a mentor, you need somebody to bounce those ideas off, and that's probably the only bit I got wrong. So it's probably a bit overtrained.
Okay.
Portion.
Yeah. So, enduro riding, it will relate to other sports that go on for longer durations, but what's your typical feeding, depending on the distance that you're doing, but what's your typical rationale when you're actually doing these events? Do you have a perfect perfect formula, a random formula, an approximate formula? How do you play it?
I'd start, let's say if it was a race like the British Enduro Champs over 90k, one lap in Scotland, very varied terrain, so it may have some dirt road, some real technical sections, big climbs that you'd be down into. On a mountain bike, you'd be on a 2x10 setup, so that's two chain rings up front and 10 at the back. You could easily be running a 32, 36, so lower than 1-to-1 gearing on a bike. You'd be pretty much nose of a saddle, beating the rhythm out for 20 minutes. I would definitely use all my experience to try and minimise my energy output in the first part. First 10K, there'd be people want to get to the front, and you know, I think at that race last year there was probably about 10 guys all pushing to the front to the first climb, wanting to drive it on. Everybody's everywhere, and I must ride without going into the red. I will try and preserve every piece of what I'm going to need for the latter part of the race. So preservation for the first 10K, and that means following people, not pushing to the wind, using my technical skills to enable me to be more efficient to deliver the minimum to get over the first 10K-ish.
Yeah.
Often somebody that might know me would try to destroy that, so they go absolutely ballistic on the first climb. And it's how I play that would be, if they're going to push me red, I will not go in. And if they can maintain that kind of pace and they've got it, then they can have the win.
Yeah.
It's out of my control. So I would then work with people to chase that person down. I would actively use people without them probably knowing it. Always contributing, but not always contributing. If you're the strongest guy in a group, and you show you're the strongest guy in the group, nobody wants to ride with you, like on the road, or whether it's a triathlon or a mountain bike race. Obviously, in a mountain bike race, you can combine it with technical skills as well. So you can apply technical skills to all the physical things that allow you to then preserve energy for the latter part of the race. And, you know, that then will save, you know, the last 20Ks of Enduro. Often people could be watching it thinking, you know, I'm in the right place. You know, they may look from the outside and think he's in the right place, but he's not going to win this. And in the last 10K, something, the energy preservation from early on really kicks in.
Yeah. And how long is that typical duration for a 90K?
I guess 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
Four hours, something like that.
Yeah. So feeding during that is what?
Feeding is, there'd be set feed zones.
Yeah.
I've got gels and liquid energy.
Yeah.
So I'm taking on, once the event started, I'd be fully fueled up for that event, probably feeling a little bit heavy on the start line, a little bit loaded with fluid, and get into it, get the sweat rates going, start feeding straight away, and I'm feeding, drip feeding for the whole event, and it's critical, absolutely critical. Get that feeding wrong, and you know, it could be when I'm sat with one guy going through and off on a dirt road, I may drink when he can't see me drinking. I'm not out training with this guy. He's not really, he might be a friend out of the race, but he's not going to see me feeding to remind him to feed. My feeding strategy is quite important part of what I'm doing.
Yeah, and it's an important tactical.
Yeah.
It's a tactical thing. Yeah.
So I've, you know, I don't know if everybody does this, but I choose which pocket which food goes in. So if it's a caffeine gel, that's in my right pocket, which is more difficult to get out. My left pocket is the standard gel. So they come first, and the food I need later on isn't, you know, I won't accidentally have a caffeine gel in 10K into the event, so it's, you know, it's all there. And you know, I won't always, you know, I could have somebody feeding me. These feed zones are in all sorts of obscure places, difficult to find. I will carry extra.
Yeah.
If I miss one feed, it will not cost me a race.
Yeah.
And probably, let's say, for instance, that race will have 3 feed zones. I miss the middle feed. My feeder just got there as I'd gone through. It didn't matter. It really didn't matter. So it's really important to feed, because it's all, you know, I'm not superhuman. I'm just kind of, I've just worked out the best way of doing the best performance where I'm at now.
Yeah.
And people go, you've got the experience to do it. Yes, I have got the experience to do it. You still need to be physically good. And I actually lost that race by 7 seconds, having crashed. And Lee Williams won it, and he rode a good race. But I know for a fact that he was cramping towards the end. And you know, after my crash, I almost caught him on the line because he was cramping. So his feeding strategy wasn't quite right. Enduro mountain bike is, it's not to be confused with Enduro downhill, by the way, because we have a new sport that's really taking off, and that's this combination between downhill racers and fit downhill racers, and then XC cross country racers that can ride downhill well. So it's actually a long downhill with bits of uphill in it.
Yeah.
So you have to be fit.
And yeah.
That's got the name Enduro. So we are talking about marathon. Is probably a better way of describing
marathon cross country.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Not to be misleading.
Yeah. And years ago, and you know, they're still readily available, everybody looked at the Camelback as the tool of the off-road rider, and now it's all gone back to bottles.
I never
I did one lap of a cross country race in 90 something, like 93 or 4 when they first came out, and realised that carrying a litre of water on my back wasn't really for me. So I never ever used one again. I've always been bottles.
Yeah.
I found it really interesting when somebody like Dave Miller was saying I'm using a Camelback and it becomes an aerodynamic tool, which is amazing because actually he doesn't have to take his hands off, he doesn't have to come out of his aero position to feed. And am I right in saying that when you're in your aero tuck position, you're actually, it's almost like a fairing on the back of your back?
Yeah.
So
which is why they're banned. Which is why they're now banned.
Oh right, okay. I wouldn't know they were banned. But
then they're kind of, I think in some cases they were reinstated, and you know, because to ban something that can help riders stay hydrated is probably not a great, in the grand scheme of things that could be banned, it's not a great thing. One of the things that interested me, what you said then, was that you said, you know, you're on the start line, you're kind of a bit, you know, full up and stuff like that. It's not too dissimilar to the marathoners who, because they are body weight orientated, and you are because you've got lots more ups and downs than other sports, it's actually interesting that the second half can be faster by the fact that the athlete is significantly lighter. Mm. So marathoners are looking to run possibly negative splits by the fact that they'll lose, you know, a litre and a half in the first hour, but they start the second half marathon a kilogram and a half less. And if that's, you know, a 54 kilogram athlete, you're talking between 2.5% and 3% lighter.
Yeah, you can feel, you just purely feel it on sensation, you can feel that in an event that you get lighter. The modern cross country now, the new cross country is a lot shorter. It's an hour and a half, it could be an hour 15 even. It's more purpose built, technically demanded, and less of an endurance feat. The old cross country that, you know, the Olympics I rode, the winning time was 2.5 hours, which is almost marathon distance now. So it was different back in the day that I rode cross country at that level.
But you said the word marathon, which is interesting because marathons are where people first start to think about carbo loading as a relevant thing.
Yeah.
And you're going up around that 3 hour point, so it is about who's got high glycogen stores at the start.
You probably know more than me about this, but I always believe that when I was storing carbs, I was storing fluids. So in the lead up to the event, the day before, the food I took on, if that was carbohydrate with fluid, was storing. It felt like I was storing fluid along with carbohydrate, and I would feel pretty heavy, heavy legged.
Yeah.
And once you get into the event, the difference between an endurance road event though is that the road guys, whenever I rode a road stage race, I rode the Pro Tour in 98, you could start heavy. All the pros roll into the first stage was 132 miles with a 10 mile neutralized. I rode 150 miles on the first day of that Pro Tour. And you ride into it. You feed from the car, you take bottles, you take food, and you can start reasonably full.
Yeah.
Mountain biking is really odd because even those the old cross countries and now marathons, they can start at quite a ballistic rate. The first 10 minutes can be really up there. And it's having the ability to know that you're not going to feel great, but it's worth it. And that's what I do. I will feel not great in the first 10 minutes. And actually, it leads a few people that have come to it not fueled up into false sense of that they've got the better of me today. Yeah. And they haven't. They've just started with probably less loaded up and less fluid stored. And
gone harder.
And probably gone harder because they can. And, you know, I know what the red zone is, and I like to stay out of the red zone as much as possible until it makes a difference to winning a race or getting a result that I need.
Yeah.
And, I, you know, we're talking a lot about endurance here, but I still ride cyclocross in the winter, and that's real top end.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I spend the winter at the top end, and I love it. So I'm actually enjoying both sides.
Yeah.
But I separate the two, really. I quite like to get to the national cross champs in mid-January and then stop and just enjoy riding a bike again from more endurance building. Lots of zone one, looking for good weather, riding in the, on the good days, and enjoying riding the bike again.
Yeah, yeah. And that, you know, that gives you a chance to sort of recover from the cross and build again towards the, you know, the marathon cross country stuff, and actually have almost like a trip, well, a double season, but almost with like a double peak, but spread out.
I really enjoy watching Sven Nys. Now he's won the world champs yet again. It was so he has kept his career alive by doing mountain biking. So he's using mountain biking, cross is his main sport. By, you know, he rode the Olympics in London as a mountain biker. Cyclocross isn't an Olympic sport, but he makes, you know, a great living and a great career, and he's the measure of all cyclocross in this era. In the last 15 years, he is everything to measure cross by, and he's stretched. If you know, if you believe what you read, they talk a lot about him getting his endurance from his mountain bike to take to his cross, and it really makes so much sense when you read about what he's doing.
Yeah.
And you know, the balance and all the technical things is a great little piece of him. Picking water bottle, he was in Louisville for the Cross Worlds, and there's a piece on YouTube where he starts messing around. I think he takes his leg warmers off while he's on the rollers, and then he bends down and picks a bottle up off the floor. And you just realise that this guy has got so much balance, so much coordination, so much power, and delivers it in a fantastic way. So I'm inspired by seeing these guys doing it. And he's I think he's 36, 37, and he's just smashed the world apart in the cross wheels again.
So, because you're technically orientated, and mountain biking is just... it's been an evolutionary hotbed for quite a while now, and we're getting this, you know, new 29er category, and you know, wheels are getting bigger, and we're going 27.5 as well. Particularly for those people that wouldn't know a lot about going on in mountain biking, and you know, mountain bikes can look like, you know, it's just a hack bike that somebody rides to work on, but actually when you look at the technical level to which they're being developed, it's at or above what's happening in road or tri. Give us a quick resume of what's going on in, you know, in mountain bike technology, particularly from, you know, you're a genius with the genius.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, the Scott stuff. What's going on?
Scott lead the carbon technology.
Right.
And when I saw Tom Strushnek's scale frame in 2005.
Yeah.
I looked at it and just saw geometry perfect from a distance. Front forks travel was getting longer. So we were running at about 60 mil front fork travel. We were going to 80 mil, and there was talk of 100 mil. Everything now is 100 mil cross country. And the problem was, on the smaller frame sizes, I ride a medium, and the head tube, if you're going to add more travel in the fork, if you're going to add more travel, the fork gets longer. If you can't keep the head tube, if you can't reduce the head tube from the underneath to accept that fork,
it's got
to
go up.
You're messing the geometry.
Yeah, yeah.
You mess the geometry up. The front end comes up. Athlete like me knows that I know exactly what my offset is, so how far nose of saddle behind BB is, and I then know my reach. So if I put a longer fork into a frame, the BB is slightly higher, the head angle slightly slacker, but the main thing for me is the reach is shortened.
Right. Okay.
So then I put a longer stem on to correct the reach.
Yeah.
So now I've got a bike that won't, when my brain says go right, there's a delay. And that delay is, you know, I want the responsive.
Yeah.
When I want brain to hand to turn to happen really quite sharply. So when I saw Thomas Frischneck's bike, it had a head tube of around 100 millimetres on a medium, and it could accept an 80 mil fork at the time. And I thought, that is incredible. Then I realised that actually I picked the whole bike up and thought, that feels as light as a road bike that I was riding at that time. And I was amazed at how I was riding a carbon bike at the time, and it didn't weigh anything like what Frisch's bike weighed.
Right.
So I then started to look into it a bit more, and we were talking under a kilo, 980 grams then for a frame that was built for mountain biking.
Yeah.
This isn't cutting corners. This is properly strong.
Yeah.
Built for, fit for purpose to race World Cup, World Championships, and it's not for jumping off 3 foot drop offs and not knowing how to ride it.
Yeah.
If you ride off a drop off and you land correctly, it's perfectly up to the job.
Yeah.
So good riding. It was built for going anywhere. So it's just gone on and on and on from there. And we're talking now 899 grams for a mountain bike frame. Scott keep innovating and yeah, taking it a step further, because if they don't, you know, the other brands try to get close and they do close in, and Scott just keep innovating. And I know that I work for Scott, so you could easily say, oh, this is just a sales pitch, or it's because you work for Scott you say that, and it's genuine. I genuinely believe that Scott are so focused on the innovation and development of really good product that's why I'm with them, and I really enjoy working with them. Mm. Wheel sizes, we were all mountain bike was 26.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Yeah.
The clunkers, the bikes in the 70s that the Americans had.
Yeah.
They were all they went out and looked for a wheel, and it was a 26 was what was lying around, basically.
So yeah, like the cruisers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what we raced. Then the 29er came around.
Yeah. Was there a UCI rule on the size of the wheel?
No.
So it just was 26 because of, you know, because obviously on the road 700 had been fixed and they couldn't use 650, or they could a little bit for TTs, but they couldn't use it in the road, and then they stayed with the 700. But there was no reason then that it didn't need to move off of 26. It just had become 26 was the way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the only UCI rule was the tyre size.
Okay.
1.5 inch.
Yeah.
Minimum width.
Yeah.
So that was it. We... Then the 29er thing came around.
Yeah.
And obviously, when you go to a bigger wheel, you've got geometry compromises. Yeah. And that takes a while for people to work out.
Mm.
And, you know, you could, if you invent something or an idea, if you take an idea and you're the first person, you're not necessarily going to be the person that makes the best final job of it.
Mm.
And, you know, Gary Fisher, I believe, was the first person that really pushed 29er. Oh, right.
Yeah.
And he's doing okay, but it's, you know, if you look at where Scott came into it a few years ago, we've got this, you know, we've got these great designers and engineers that can work and make a product. Obviously, one of the problems is you've got a longer wheelbase.
Yeah.
And it's getting those wheels to work in with the right geometry. And the you know, we curve our seat tube. A curved seat tube allows us to have a chainstay that is short enough to still be responsive.
Yeah.
And we need to... The challenges are on the smaller sizes, because a head tube has to be a certain size in engineering terms.
Yeah.
And we have a bigger wheel which has a longer fork, so you're challenged at the front end by ride height. So the guys, Nino Schurter and Florian Vogel at Swiss Power, were working towards what, you know, Florian had taken the 29 and Nino Schurter was saying, I can't ride. He rides a very aggressive position at the front end, and he would really struggle on a 29er to get that position that he likes and that works for him.
Right.
And it was suggested that, hang on, there's a wheel size in between here that could work, and that'll be 650B.
Yeah.
We call it 27 and a half because it makes sense to people. It's between the two. It's actually fractionally near a 26 and 29. And I totally get that wheel size. I'm 5'8". I believe we shouldn't size... We don't choose our wheel size by our height only. It's a combination of a lot of things. It's what purpose the bike's for.
Mm-hmm.
It's... your riding style, how much fun you want from a bike.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's all relative. And then also you can take height into the calculation as well.
Do you ever go across to 29er?
Yeah.
You do, yeah.
So for purely for efficiency and trying to win an event like an Enduro, I'm riding a Spark, which is 100 mil, 29er.
Yeah.
XC marathon bike that I will race in the national points round this coming weekend. I do actually have a hardtail, which is a non-rear suspension for triathletes that don't mountain bike.
Yeah.
Maybe listen to this. I have a 27.5 scale frame that the guys rode at the Olympic Games in London last year, and I'm really looking forward to racing that.
Right.
In the coming season.
And what would you say is the fundamental difference between those two rides?
Feedback.
Okay.
So how much feedback? One.
Is the 27 a bit more responsive, a bit more aggressive, a bit more, not twitchy, but a bit more responsive?
It's more responsive.
Yeah, when the bigger's just got a bit more lag in it.
Yeah. We as XC racers, we would not have gone there. Up to the year 2000, we were well clear of full suspension bikes for racing because of lateral stiffness.
Yeah.
There was no lateral stiffness. Whenever you put the power down, the bike was going sideways.
Yeah.
Things have changed. Stiffness.
And so, positioning now of where the system is, it's completely...
Bigger bearings, further apart, bigger pivots... Clever engineering, making things stiffer, bolt through axles, all kinds of a mountain of technology that's been developed through Scott and through through the whole package of things that are available to make your bike stiffer.
Yeah.
You know, it's your combination of your wheels, your bolt throughs, so many things making the bike stiffer. But still, however stiff that bike is, when you press on the pedal, the feedback from a hardtail is different to a full suspension bike.
Right.
And that's a pleasure in itself.
And we spoke about, and you might well just say no, but we spoke about a certain group set, evolution and stuff like that was going, certain things were happening. Is that commonly known about, or is it a top secret sort of thing?
I think it's quite secret, really.
But so things are, people will look at mountain bikes probably in less than 12 to 18 months and go, blimey, look what's happened there. That's all kicked off, and that's a completely different avenue again. There's
at the minute now, Joe, the most exciting thing is less chain rings at the front.
Yeah.
So we've gone from triple.
Yeah.
To usually it was three chain rings at the front, nine at the back, giving us 27 gears. The overlap was massive.
Yeah.
So we'd use about 21 of those gears of the 27. Now, what we've got now is we then go 2x10.
Yeah.
So we've got 20 gears, and instead of having 21, we've got 20 chain lines better.
Here comes the gardeners just doing their little bit of cleaning. So apologies for the background noise.
It'll be siesta soon.
Yeah, it'll be siesta soon. It'll go quiet. Yeah, as the postie.
So the most exciting thing this coming year.
Yeah.
Is XX1 from SRAM.
Right.
And I've got to say, SRAM do a great job of raising the mark when it comes to developing. So they've ditched the front mech, they've gone single ring.
Yeah.
There's no chain guard holding the chain on. The chain has to be in the correct position on the chain ring. So if you put the chain back on and it isn't where it wants to be, it won't go on. The teeth are longer, and if you looked at slow-mo of Nino Schurter jumping across a gap jump at the Olympic Games, his chain's going up and down by about 4 inches and left to right by 3 inches. And it doesn't come off. There's clutches in the huge springs and clutches built into the rear mech. It's an 11 speed, so it's 1x11.
Yeah.
It's got a 1042 and options of all different chainring sizes.
A 1042?
Yeah.
Wow. So for those that's 10 tooth small and 42 tooth big at the back, giving a massive spread.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a piece of beauty. It really is, and I, you know, it's really exciting, these developments. I just think the biggest part, that probably the biggest part of that working is the biggest thing going from three rings to two rings. I noticed that the rear cassette wasn't wearing the same sprockets out. So with three chain rings, I would wear the third and fourth sprocket out. And after fitting, when I get to the third chain, when I've got to wear point, it might not ride in those sprockets. And it's quite frustrating when you know the rest of the cassette's in good condition.
Yeah.
When you go 2x10, it's the load was spread across more sprockets. So I found that the cassettes are lasting longer. And that's now available down the group set, so XO. It's fed down to a more affordable point for most people. Mm. Well, when we go 1x11, the wear is going to be more spread across the whole cassette, and it's just a simple life. It's so simple. At the front end, you can have a thumb shift or a twist shift. So the old grip shift, 11-speed grip shift. When you spin your bars around, it won't smack into your carbon top tube. There's very little cabling. It's just really, really nice and simple, and I'm really excited about riding that group set on our bike this year. Yeah.
So that's also going to bring, because there's no limit to bike weight, so it's going to bring bike weight down a bit more.
Yeah, we're down to about 16 pounds for a bike of that calibre now.
Yeah.
Carbon wheels on mountain bike. I was always a bit anti-carbon wheels on 26, because practically an alloy rim was doing the job perfectly well. We use tubeless systems, so we're tubeless, and we can run really low pressures down to 22 psi without burping air outside in the corners. It's a fantastic ride on a hardtail. We get loads of grip. Maximum pressure I would ever run would be 28 or 30 psi.
Yeah.
And as low as 22.
Right.
As wheel size have got bigger,
yeah,
all of a sudden, what I would have always said, carbon rims are for hairdressers. I think now, actually, I might have to eat my words. As wheels have got bigger, so 27.5 and 29, we need the stiffness in the wheel, because we can only tension a spoke so far.
Yeah.
And if we want a stiffer wheel beyond the tension that that long spoke can offer, the carbon rim really kicks in.
Yeah.
So carbon rims are coming in, and I've just taken a very nice set of 27.5 Syncross carbon rimmed Sappy X-ray spoked mountain bike wheels that will be tubeless and flying around in the 27.5. I'm looking forward to getting those.
Is that more about the sort of structural integrity, but alongside you get a weight drop in the wheel, or is there not that much difference in the alloy to carbon weight?
There is a difference, but it's not huge.
No.
It's about stiffness and performance, really.
Yeah.
There's a lot of it is stiffness. And it's, you know, particularly with the 29, I think it'll make a huge difference having the carbon giving more stiffness to the rim.
Yeah. Wow. And, you know, for a lot of people, mountain bikes are, you know, they've got their road bike, or they've got their, you know, the tri bike, and a mountain bike is kind of it's an add-on. It is. They're not purely, a mountain bike. So it's an add-on bike. And when you look, and I've seen some of the team bikes that the Southfork Racing guys ride, and I've picked them up and I've looked at them, and it's like a completely different planet. I mean, it's a phenomenal piece of kit, and the levers and the carb weight. And my first mountain bike was a Specialized Rockhopper. You know. Hard front, hard back, and, you know, that was mountain biking in the late 80s, and it was hilarious. And you look at them now, and they're on a different planet. I mean, they are phenomenal. So if you're seeing, you know, these next few, you know, evolutionary steps as coming in fairly soon, you're going to be looking at things that are just continuing to become just almost like you couldn't jump off the road and get onto a mountain bike without almost going through a massive education of the difference in what this whole technology is all about.
Yeah, I am really excited about the future of bike development. I think people keep saying, you know, every year we bring new products and there's new things. And some people will say, oh, it's just to sell people more. Mm. Just
Okay, I challenge that person not to buy anything for 5 years. Yeah. Use what they've got,
yeah,
and then have a look at where we are, because yeah, things are developing, and I really like the freedom that mountain biking has to develop products.
Yeah, yeah.
The road is a bit more restrictive,
yeah,
but it's still getting nicely developed,
yeah,
but it is a bit more restricted. So some freedom in mountain bike, what, you know, watch this space, see what happens, and
yeah,
you know, if that ultimately allows you to enjoy and gives you pleasure in the sport you love, then it's better yeah than drinking too much booze and getting fat, I think.
Yeah, yeah. They're, you know, they're tools to us all to have fun, effectively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not quite how to put that, did I?
So I think that was put very succinctly. Okay, so we've got, I think, just a couple more minutes before my computer decides it's going to shut down. What do you think is the biggest single change in how now you see people that come into sort of, you know, particularly enduro stuff? How do you see people changing the way that they approach it? Because it seems as though we went through a big surge of, you know, mountain biking being all about, you know, the, what that time was, you know, it was, well, you just did cross country, people just did that, and then you started to get downhill, then you obviously started to, you know, get all the evolutions that came off of that, and we're into more enduro, and you got the, you know, the 12-hour 24-hours enduros. There's a lot of different people that are now experiencing mountain biking for the first time. Where do you see the big sort of surge? Where do you see most of the people coming from other sports or even within the sport going to? Where, what do you think is going to be the sort of the happening thing?
At the minute, happening is enduro downhill.
Yeah.
That's where people are going. And it's yeah, it's a lovely combination between a DH rider, so a downhill racer.
Yeah.
That a bike...
That has to have a bit of fitness.
Yeah. I mean, you see them and they can't even get from the car to the chairlift. They have to walk the bike because that's what the bike is. And
yeah, yeah,
that's that. They're the rules that they work to. Their bike yeah has to come downhill quick.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really nice to see that development. The sport has come around where yeah there's mid ground. So something like our new Genius for 2013
yeah
has 27.5 and 29 inch options, 150 and 130 mil travel.
Wow.
The 27.5, 150 mil travel is, you know, that bike, I want to get in one of those events and see how good it is down. I've ridden it around Cwmcarn in South Wales and I really enjoy what that bike does, but you know, when you have to kick up a climb and you've got a twin lock lever, you've got all these options to make this thing, pilot this bike to go quick over a mixed terrain. So it's a really good portion of technical downhill with some kicks uphill, and it's a really good combination because I was a downhill racer in the early 90s that's gone cross country, enduro, and cyclocross, and there are a portion of DH riders that are fit, like yeah Steve Peat is yeah very fit, and when yeah Steve Peat decides not to race, when Steve Peat decides to race enduro
yeah
downhill
yeah
watch out.
Yeah, do you know what that was going to be my next question was, do you think Steve Peat's going to make a crossover?
Yeah, I'm sure he will. He might not want it. I haven't actually asked him that question yeah or spoken to him about yeah it. But
do you think it's a natural evolution just for DH riders?
Yeah, Tracy Mosley.
Yeah.
She, you know, she turned up and she did the cross-country World Cup at Dalby, and she is one fit girl. And she is now doing downhill enduro, and Helen Gaskill, an ex-top downhill racer, now enduro downhill. It's really exciting.
How long does it take, roughly, each enduro as a ballpark number? Don't know.
They vary massively. I mean, right, the classic one that's kind of brought this about, I believe, is the Mega Avalanche, which goes from the top of the ski station, the very top of Alpe d'Huez, to a portion almost to the bottom. So we're talking about 50 minutes. And that has some uphills, yet they start on the
they start on the ice of the glacier at the top. So right. If you want to see what that's all about, just stick it in YouTube and have a look.
And it's called again?
The Mega Avalanche.
The Mega Avalanche.
And they start them in waves of 500. It's a qualifying event. And
sorry, say that phrase again. They start them in waves of 500.
Mass start. Hovering helicopter on a glacier. Have a look. It's quite interesting. And I know it's probably worlds apart from what most of you see, but this is the, you know, when I started cycling, you had a road rider that rode some track, you had a cross rider that rode some road, and you had some tourists that would do some, you had some road riders that do some rough stuff, and road racers.
Yeah.
That's, you could pretty much put bike riders into four categories. I'm going to guess it's probably 21 categories of bike rider now.
Yeah.
From the new golf, the people that have, you know, cycling being the new golf, so sportif road riders to free riders, which are, they'll wear all the kit and they'll have a biggish bike and they'll smash up power climbs and go quick downhill.
Yeah.
But if you put them on an XC, they'll struggle.
Yeah.
You've got all these different categories of rider. Yeah. And I think it's really exciting. And what we must all remember is we are all cyclists or bike riders.
Yeah, because there used to be quite a bit of stupid friction between, you know, mountain bikers saying, oh, you kind of lycra a lot. And then the fit road rider saying, yeah, but you downhillers aren't that fit because you only go downhill. And there was kind of a bit of, and then you realize that certain people move between fields, or actually, do you know what? We're actually all in the same field. It's just you have different reasons to want to be on two wheels.
Yeah.
And actually, it's quite humbling to jump across into a different aspect of something that you don't understand and do it, and then realize that every sport, the iconic people that do it at a very high level are amazing, and that even people that do it as their weekend, they're amazing because they've adapted their kit and their training and their approach to be able to do that sport or just that weekend's type of riding. And they're all different. Nobody can cross over across all of it. Mm. And yet they all have been on two wheels, getting that, you know, even it might not be adrenaline. It might just be a level of, you know, of achievement having done a certain climb or a certain sportif or a certain distance. And with the way I see it, with the evolution of bikes being able to be specifically, you know, kitted out and designed and built and understood, then there's no end of actually where we can go, because bikes can actually aid people that aren't naturally able to do those things. But if they've got the right gear, they can do it a lot better.
Yeah.
You know, the early mountain bikes were really, really nasty. When you look at them now, you think, my God, the bike did nothing. It just all went through the body, and the body just took one heck of a hammering.
Yeah, I used to have trouble getting my socks on after a race. I used to have that, you know, I used to be so, you know, I used to put it down to being 19 or 20, and, you know, your ligaments are all loose in your lower back, so you can't hold yourself. But the truth is, I was getting beaten by, I was getting pummeled by the bike.
Yeah.
And that's not happening now.
Yeah.
I can ride 100k
yeah.
on a nice plush, comfy, big wheeled bike.
Yeah.
And I can go to work the next day. It's not, you know, I'm not stiff, I'm not in pain. The truth is I actually feel better having ridden than when I haven't ridden now.
Mm.
So that's my life in my 40s.
Yeah.
If I don't ride, I get tight. I get tight glutes, lower back, hamstrings. When I ride my bike, I'm warm. I'm not going to claim to be any angel about stretching, but I stretch when I get up, when I brush my teeth and wash my face. And then I ride or do sport, having driven and been sat in a car, bolt stiff. And then when my body's warm, I stretch a bit.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I do it without really thinking about it. Just think, oh, that needs doing. Or,
yeah.
And I've learned what I need to do for my body to make me feel better. And that usually involves some kind of pedaling is the best thing for me.
Mm.
I struggle to run. I try to run a bit, and I seem to have done that much pedaling that running doesn't really...
Yeah, when you're that aerobically fit and you're that lean power to weight that you can run... You're not trying to drag a 90 kilo low fitness body around and going, God, this running, I can't stay in zone one. Anyway, you have got to go out on your bike. I need to stop us at something around about an hour and a quarter. And I'll tell you what, you could still be here tomorrow and we'd have to keep recording. Because you wouldn't stop.
No, sorry, Joe.
No, guys. No,
if you want to split this into four parts, feel free.
We're going to do more, because I know there's some other subjects that we've done this as a round. We'll do another couple of other subjects whereby we just go through some specifics and you give out stuff that I know is, and I'm not going to butt you up, but is actually wisdoms of, you know, decades of experience that you can pass across to people. But let's get you out on the bike. Let's end part one, and we'll be back in a bit.
Thank you. Sun cream.
Test, 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 1, 2, 3. March the 19th.
Wolf, bark, donkey.
What?
Yeah. Wolf, bark, donkey.
Wolf, bark, donkey. Okay.